Talk given Friday, 28th February, 1975. In recent meetings, we have been considering love and the divine abidings, as they are called. We have also considered a problem which is a much more difficult problem to deal with in our own day and age than it was centuries ago. The problem of living the religious life in our present day secular environment. There are certain key points which we must understand very clearly in connection with all this. Let us start with seeing quite clearly that the discipline of the religious life affects the transformation of the individual person. A complete transformation. As you all know, the context of religion, in one word, is transcendence itself. And this transformation of the whole individual fundamentally is a transformation of his mode of awareness of existence. It may be said, we have heard this often enough before. We have certainly heard the words. We have had ideas about it. We have had some sort of experience, perhaps, in relation to it. This transformation of the mode of awareness of existence. But have we been able to listen completely and totally in the real sense? If there has been complete listening, then there would be total obedience where transcendence is concerned. Now, I use this word obedience deliberately because the word itself derived from audire, to hear, to listen, is most intimately bound up with this state of listening, which is not merely a listening to sounds. It is a listening to the total reality of in which sound plays a very small part. That total reality this total reality is basically a stillness and a silence. It is a rhythm of creative action in eternity. It transcends movement as we ordinarily understand movement. It is movement which makes noise, disturbance, and it is movement which is associated with what we call the life process in all finite creatures or things. But all this is only a fragment of that tremendous totality. Now, to listen to the totality, and if one can listen to the totality, means to obey, to be in utter harmony, utter union with that totality. The nature of this union is indescribable. The nature of this union is such that none of our criteria, absolutely none of our criteria, which are confined to our realm of thought and ideas and verbal formulations, apply. They simply don't apply there. Otherwise, transcendence would not be transcendence. It would be something finite, limited, mortal, sinful, sorrowful, confused, chaotic. So now, let me just repeat the two statements. That the discipline of the religious life brings about the transformation of the individual. And the essential aspect of this transformation is the transformation of his mode of awareness of existence. Now let us go back to this difficult problem of living the pure life, the good life, the religious life, the life which is utterly and completely the human life. The problem of living that life in our actual environment. You will have glimpsed from what has been said already that the living of that life is something which is very difficult to know. We think we know it, or we can know at least a part of it. We think of the good life as the pure life, the moral life, the sensible life, the intelligent life, the life in which we perceive deep truths, as we call them. Yes, all that is involved. But it is the very beginning only. You have often heard me say, saintship is the beginning of the spiritual life. It's not the culmination. The one who is the real saint, and this applies therefore to the pure heart as well as the enlightened mind, that is the beginning of the spiritual life. So we think that we know what is meant by this good life. And you may wonder why I seem to depreciate the conventional conception of what is the religious life and the good life. Note very carefully to what are all our ideas, all our techniques and our practices with respect to the good life related. What is their root source? Something which entangles us all the time. Something which binds us. And something which is indeed the progenitor, the prolific progenitor of our failures, of our misconceptions, our misdeeds, and so forth. All our ideas are bound up with the consciousness of self, the me, the I. This is where our fundamental difficulty lies. Those of you who have faithfully come year after year have heard me talk about mindfulness till you might almost feel a bit repelled if I mention the word mindfulness. But you see, we have not begun even to be mindful in the real sense. Every day of our life, practically all day long, have you noticed how this self-consciousness is there, usually in the forefront? And if it is not in the forefront, it is the most powerful factor operating inside us. Have you ever known the magic, the beauty, and indescribable wonder of the reality, the real experiencing of unself-consciousness? Because in that state of unself-consciousness, you are at one, completely at one with the totality, with reality. If at any moment that comes upon me in my life, then there is no obtrusion by the me upon the totality. Otherwise, I am always a block in the way of the totality. It's only the extremely earnest, the person who gives his whole being to the realization of religious living, religious fulfillment, which means to the realization of one's true and full humanity, It's only he who knows how this self-consciousness obtrudes upon the world. This is the state of the fall. Adam fell. What was that fall? The loss of complete unity, complete harmony with totality. Even this phrase which I use has its verbal flaws, because there is the implication when I say unity with, that means one thing with another. The fall consists in being something which obtrudes upon the wholeness, the unitary wholeness of the totality. This is the state, the fallen state. So now, this self-consciousness, this whole complex, which is the me, the body, the feelings, the thoughts, the ideas, the inspirations, the aspirations, everything, all this constitutes the me. And our whole consciousness, our whole so-called attentiveness and mindfulness, is never free of this me. Therefore, we never see truth in the religious meaning of the word. And the religious meaning of the word truth is the reality which is the transcendent itself. There is no description, there is no definition of it. The word truth in the languages of the world is used quite legitimately in the limited context, the worldly context, when we talk of historical truth or the legal truth or the whatever, any other truth, the scientific truth or anything. Because there all our contexts are limited. They are confined. So, all right. That's how the word truth is used there. But truth, in the context of religion, in the true sense, in the deep sense, the heart of religion, which is the context of transcendence, truth is transcendence itself, which is the indefinable, the immeasurable, the absolute. Now that doesn't mean that transcendence is there, oh, so far away, these ice-cold Himalayan heights, I can't get there, says the man in despair. You see, how ignorant is the man who says that. He doesn't know he's right in it. There are not icy Himalayan heights in the distance. It is right here. It is right within me, actually. But there is this other thing, self-consciousness, this me-ness, which holds on to the limited, the particular, the finite, the painful, the sorrowful, the dying. It is I who cling to the Lord of death. But the Lord of death would willingly liberate me if I let go of the Lord of death. And then I discover that he is the immortal twin of the Lord of life. Remember, I talked of life in this transcendent sense as a rhythmic pulsation, as a rhythmic pulse. In words, people have called it the life-death pulse. I never call it the life-death pulse now. I used to in the past, following all the writers of the past. I call it the life-other-life pulse. So now, this me is the thing to which we relate everything. Our attempt to live religiously, therefore, is vitiated at the source. This is our great difficulty. And the more and more clearly we can see this, really see it, in the seeing comes the liberation. Because when you see with that intensity, you are that which is seen. And why is it that you are that which is seen, and in this case, you are seeing the transcendent? One has to use limited words like seeing or touching or whatever you like. Seeing is the most convenient word, therefore we use it, you see. Why is the seeing the actual being? Because in that state, that tremendous intensity of attentiveness, of attention, there is no self-consciousness. There is no relating the thing to a me. You have gone right beyond it. In that intensity of attentiveness. In that intensity of attentiveness, you cannot know, in our sense of the word, that you have gone right beyond it, because there is no you which has gone. The totality is suddenly free of the you, the I, the me, obtruding upon it. I am the devil's shadow in the way of God's eternal being. But this is a real experiencing. So difficult to state, so difficult to try and grasp with the mind. But in the actual experiencing, suddenly that totality is there. And you see, when that happens, none of our criteria, none of our thoughts, our conceptions, beliefs, convictions, dogmas, doctrines, what we have stated as the eternal verities, have any place. Where the eternal verity is concerned, nothing else has any place. There is no else, that's the whole point. There is no otherness. This is the supreme meaning of crucifixion, resurrection, ascension. This is the supreme meaning of the Upanishadic phrases, realizing the Atma. Become Brahman, the totality itself. Your theologian, your philosopher, and your dear, sweet, practical, commonsensical, decent man of the world will say, oh, these people must be either quite crazy or the most appallingly conceited people. No, that is not so. In words it sounds as if it is. But in the reality of experiencing, there is only transcendence manifest through you. That is the actual fact. Now you see, when the attentiveness, the mindfulness, is at that white hot intensity, and there is no me, there are none of my criteria, etc., interfering, then the transformation of your awareness of existence has taken place. When it happens to you, and you look at this person here, you will certainly see the same face, the same body, etc. And you will also see something utterly different. Utterly different, and yet containing this which you see in the ordinary way too. And there'll be no differentiation between them. When you are in the deep states of consciousness, not the very deep states, but more or less deep states compared with the ordinary worldly state of consciousness, a person, a tree, a wall, a house, a cloud appear different to your eyes. The song of a bird, the roar of the engine of the train as it goes past, all sounds different. Actually, your brain registers it differently. If you understand this, you will suddenly see light as to why the great artists of the world have painted archangels and angels and the child Christ, or if you are in a Christian milieu, or similar things in a Hindu or a Buddhist milieu, you'll see why they have painted them quite differently from the way in which we see things with our ordinary everyday eyes. It is not only a case of their imagination projecting something out of a worldly mind and a worldly vision, that which is different from what ordinary eyes see. It's not just that. They do see also different. And they see meaningfully in a way which is quite beyond our ordinary seeing and interpreting. Now, if and as such a transformation may take place, takes place, what happens to what here and now I call my problems? What happens to them? They are no longer present for me. Now let us look at it more concretely. Does this mean that my headache or my illness or the illness of somebody in the family, does it mean that the difficulty one may be put into because the borough council wants to compulsorily purchase your house or the difficulty that arises because your son or daughter is behaving rather stupidly with that girl or boy or whatever it may be. Do you think that all that vanishes? Not a bit of it. It doesn't. The ordinary pain and struggle and sorrow of the world is with me, because I am here in the world. This body is of the same substance as yours, as anybody else's. All that will not disappear. Unemployment or loss or whatever it may be, all those things, affairs of the world, will be present in my life, because inevitably the world life throws that in my way. Inevitably. But with this utterly transformed awareness, the problem is no longer my problem. It is my problem insofar as I do not understand that which is actually present, and insofar as I'm a slave to this self-consciousness and this me. Those elements are out. Therefore, my action deals with the situation as it really is in itself, free of the illusions, the bondages caused by self-consciousness and the me, with all its desires and fears and anxieties and longings and pursuits and ambitions and all the rest of it. The whole host of Satan and the devil and hell is out. You see? Please don't say I'm making it even more difficult to live the religious life. To live the human life, we are all living the subhuman life. And you see, this is the sad, the pathetic part of it all, the part which calls for such tremendous compassion. We are all living the subhuman life, and we try to circumvent that pain and sorrow which is the consequence of my own state of being fallen. I want to remain in the fallen state, grasp at comforts, success, security, so-called. It's a word, security is a word to hoot at these days, all over the world, you see. I want all that, plus, of course, the comfort of preening myself by saying I'm a nice, good, religious fellow. No, it won't do. What's more, life will not allow it. You remember sometime last year and also year before, we considered those words, Tov and Ra, Hebrew words, in Genesis, which stand for good and evil. That is to say, they are mistranslated as good and evil. Now look, Tov really means that which is already present, established, working, comfortable. A form which is now agreeable. The female part of the psyche in all of us, and in the case of the female human, it is stronger because the body is also female and tends that way, wants to keep, to preserve that which is agreeable. But the other side of life, creative action in eternity, having expressed itself in form, does not tolerate the continuance of the form after the critical moment of the expression is over. Therefore, it destroys the form. And man cannot prevail against the cosmos. You know how in Genesis the two words are used, Elohim and Yahweh. Elohim is this world process because of which manifestation is there and something which is agreeable and something you can get on with from day to day. But if you do, you stay put. You do not come to your human fruition. The human is the main trunk of the tree of life, not side branches, which have a limited scope, a certain degree of elasticity within which they function, and they never change. Look at the bees and the ants and so on. They've gone on for what? 300, 400, 600 million years like that. But with man it is different. Man doesn't grow out this way from the tree of life. He grows upwards to the zenith, rooted in the earth, but growing upwards to the zenith, which is nowhere, infinity. And this is Yahweh within man. It is an immanence. This immanent power which makes man grow and grow in mind and consciousness so that he realizes in uttermost fullness the meaning of the word God, Brahman, Ahura Mazda, use any word you like. It is this Yahvik immanence which comes along and says, oh no, no staying put, out with it. Elohim is translated as God in the Bible, in English, and Yahweh as the Lord. Dominus, the master, the giver of life, of new life, fresh life. Otherwise, that which has been produced will confine that life. You see? Notice how Yahweh promises help to Moses and so forth, and then meets him in the way in order to kill him. And this sort of thing happens several times. What is the significance of this? Will your scholar explain? I mean, your mere scholar. He doesn't know what it means. It means that this immanence within us, this eternal life and its creative power within us, is constantly breaking loose out of the old form and creating a finer and a finer and a better form. Consider then man's evolution. What was he like? His primordial ancestor, a primate. And look at the changes man has undergone. Has any other species undergone changes like that? No. So you see, this continuous bursting through. Now, if one understands that, not just with the intellect, that's no use. I knew it with the intellect of donkeys years ago, but it was no help. That is to say, you have to start with intellectual knowing, true enough. But you have to know it inwardly by becoming so intensely attentive and mindful that self-consciousness and the me is really out. Now you see, instead of trying to solve a problem, to solve the difficulties that confront us, any day, all day, every day, whatever it may be, this year, next year, sometime, never, you see, instead of trying to solve those problems, because our idea of solving is always related to me and what I feel is going to be pleasant and nice for me. And Ra, this Yahvic immanence which busts the whole old form, is denied. God is denied, therefore, in us. You see? So we don't approach any situation in terms of solving the problem, because it will always be self-oriented. But we understand the whole situation and we act accordingly with no self-conception interfering. Do bear in mind, I'll repeat it now, I'll repeat it till the end of my days. This does not mean that living the religious life, the good life, is intended or will bring about a sort of a cabbage happiness, a freedom from the problems and the troubles and so forth. Consider, how did the holy ones themselves die? Sri Krishna was shot by an arrow. Zarathustra was murdered in the temple as he was praying at the age of 77. The Buddha got a terrible bellyache before he died. Jesus on the cross. I ask you. Al-Halaj, who was a truly holy one, was crucified, brutally crucified. The description is horrifying, really. But you see, because they were utterly free of self-consciousness and of slavery to the me, they were free, their awareness of existence was so completely transformed that never was there any reaction of fear, of hate, of ill will, or of malevolence, or any such thing against the evildoer. You see, why we have to be truly serious about these things. The living of the religious life in its true sense calls for every single resource that we have, every faculty that we have. It calls for our hearts, our minds, for the whole body, for every single cell of the body. They all have to be awakened, vital agents of transcendence. This is the real meaning of yoga. Not all this petty little searching for comfort or pleasure or just good health or good looks in so many cases. And you see, just try and feel it out here and now. If we human beings can really be like that through the day, whatsoever happens, always alert, awake, sensitive, totally and intensely sensitive to everything. What an influence each one of us would be for the good that we shall never see come about. And we should not want to see it. If we want to see it, then all our stuff is again just self-oriented and we are just as selfish as anybody else. There's no difference between the self-indulgence of the person who spends his life in prayer and meditation and the fellow who goes to the pub and is dead drunk every day. It's self-indulgence. One is very refined, the other is not quite so refined. Now you see what I mean by this utter transformation of man and this utter transformation of the mode of awareness of existence. You are completely and utterly changed. In the past I have sometimes used this phrase. One is inside outed, turned inside out. It is the complete reversal of the worldly condition and the worldly mode of consciousness. It is the complete reversal of that. But it is a reversal which takes place, it is a purification that takes place, not through destruction, not through conflict, through fighting against evil or trying to destroy evil, but the utter transformation of evil. And where can the utter transformation of evil start and take place and come to fruition? Accepting in oneself. Understand that, and that wonderful sentence in the Bible, for instance, charity begins at home. Oh, is it in the Bible? No. Charity begins at home. That's not in the Bible, is it? No, it's a common garden saying. Yes, charity begins at home will suddenly be lit up with transcendent meaning and significance, real power behind it, begins here. Because then you have woken up to self-responsibility. And what is the true meaning then of self-responsibility? Not responsibility to this limited, confined I, myself, but the total self. So it is not you who act, the separate person. Eternal God is in action through you, the miracle. If you can get hold of this, all your problems will undergo a transformation also. I repeat, this seeing in this manner, being the truth that you see, and action, and all the action that inevitably accompanies that seeing, does not mean that you'll be free from difficulty and all the rest of it. The difficulties will be there. Pain, loss. Concretely, you have to renounce and relinquish things, possessions, status, friends, your job or anything. Supposing one's job is such that it entails inflicting hurt upon living creatures, either directly or indirectly. If you once see there is no difficulty in relinquishing the job, something else will come up. In the meantime, there may be hunger, there may be homelessness, yes. But do we want to try and sneak into the kingdom of heaven? To get into Caesar's kingdom, we need pay only a penny. But to enter the kingdom of heaven, we give our entire self. And there is no Saint Peter who will keep us out. Our not giving our entire self is what will shut the doors of heaven upon ourselves by our own action. You see, it is this which brings you, the individual, to fruition, and which is the most powerful influence, the only real influence affecting the world, affecting humanity for its real good.